We're kicking off with the Brexit because this week things seemed to ramp up a notch.
With respect, I don't think it's your job to do the selling for Boris Johnson.
No, but it is my job to ask how prepared this government is
and
if there is a no-deal Brexit.
But
see? Ramping up. Tánaiste, the Simon Coveney and Miriam O'Callaghan. And we'll hear more from that interview in a bit. But the start of the week was devoted to a leaked document, report, dossier, call it what you will, but with the rather James Bondy title of Yellowhammer. And it detailed a rather frightening scenario of what might happen should a no-deal Brexit ensue. Miriam spoke to Tory MP Marcus Fish, who frankly was having none of it.
According to the documents, petrol import tariffs could inadvertently lead to the closure of two oil refineries, while protests across Britain would require significant amounts of police resources.
Well, I just think that that's a really bad assessment. I can't see the logic of that position. To be honest, the civil service have questions to answer as to why this thing has been leaked. And I think it's part of an establishment effort to try to scare people. The point is that if you have cheap imports of fuel, then the fuel is available. Otherwise, those refiners don't have a problem.
But Marcus Fish, it's almost like, with respect, Tory MPs like you are delusional. I mean, this is your own civil service coming up with its details. It's dated this month. This is what they believe might happen.
This is what they have left in a pub for a journalist to find. I think that tells you all you need to know about the motivation.
So, a self-serving leak from the Remainer camp, eh? Well, Tuesday's drive time brought us an interview with commentator James Kirkup, who put Boris Johnson on the couch, so to speak, and sought to explain this report's leaking through a different lens, a rather Machiavellian interpretation.
I think the disruption, the immediate impact of no deal is a much easier story for the current government to respond to than, frankly, the real problem of no deal, which is simply the what next question. Because if we leave with no deal, we're still going to end up trying to do a deal. We will still need at some point to return to the negotiation table and attempt to negotiate a trade agreement with the European Union. Mm. And yet we will very likely do so in a much weaker position than we currently occupy. And that is a much harder political challenge for the government to deal with when they are trying to essentially make the idea of a no-deal exit palatable to the population. It's much easier to talk about shortage of lettuce in the shops and chaos at the ports, because that's, you can deal with that.
Why
you can
is promise, it,
you can promise mitigation. What you can't do, you can't answer that fundamental question of, okay, how will you go about getting a deal with the EU when you've left with no deal?
So, distract them with lettuce and the spirit of the Blitz will get them through. That was James Kirkup with Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time. What did Boris do? Well, he went interrailing. First stop, Berlin, where Angela Merkel politely but firmly called his bluff. She gave him 30 days to give some detail to the vagueness, which Boris welcomed as a blistering timetable with which he was happy.
Now is the moment, you rightly say, the onus is on us to produce those solutions, those ideas, to show how we can address the issue of the Northern Irish border. And that is what we want to do.
Berlin ticked off, he headed to Paris, to President Macron, who was happy to accept some petty tweaks, but he too was holding firm on sticking with the substance of the withdrawal agreement. None of which was stopping the Boris train, though.
I want to make it absolutely clear to you, Emmanuel, to the French people, that of course I want a deal. And I think we can get a deal, and a good deal. I was powerfully encouraged by our conversations last night in Berlin with our mutual friends, and I know that with energy and with creativity and application we can find a way forward for all our businesses and our citizens. And then of course we can take our relationship forward. And when I say take it forward, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Emmanuel, that it is a quite extraordinary friendship. Whatever happens with Brexit, just as French buses, I'm proud to say, ply the streets of London, your beautiful TGVs run on steel railways made in Scunthorpe by British Steel. Not a lot of people know that. In fact, the British ambassador didn't know that until I just told him. But there could be no more powerful metaphor, I think, for the cultural, the economic, the political partnership between our countries.
Great man for the metaphors. Still waiting on that plan, though. Next stop on the Grand Tour, the G7 summit in Biarritz this weekend. Now that will be interesting. Well, the ever-increasing risk of a no-deal Brexit was the focus of possibly the interview of the week. It was between Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, and Miriam O'Callaghan. It was a sparky affair, and curiously tetchy in some parts. First up, Miriam referenced an Irish Times article saying that the Irish government did not want to talk to their UK counterparts in any way about a no-deal, something Minister Coveney refuted.
Why have you and your officials declined to discuss the management of no deal? And is it true?
I mean, let me just be clear. I mean, we are not in the business of a no deal deal with the UK. First of all, we can't do that bilaterally. This is a negotiation between the UK and the EU collectively. There has been a lot of discussion over the last 2.5 years on contingency planning for a no deal.
But we're 10 weeks away at the moment. It's still your position
that
there can be no discussions with the UK on how to manage a no deal until after they leave.
No, what we're not doing. We've already put significant contingency in place, but what we are not going to do is to ignore the commitments that the British government have made over the last 2.5 years in negotiation, commitments that they've put in writing.
But Miriam was determined to call a backstop reality check on proceedings.
But all that has changed, as you and I know.
But just let me finish the point. To drop all of those commitments and to now say, well, look, that's too difficult for us to get through our parliament, so now we just want to try and do a side deal on a managed no deal. That isn't the way this is going to work.
Really? But that's not the way Boris Johnson is thinking.
Well, maybe so.
But that's the reality.
No, but if Boris Johnson's thinking doesn't change somewhat, we're heading for a no deal. We know that.
So shouldn't we prepare for that?
We are preparing for it.
With the UK, how it works.
Yeah, but we don't have a partner in the British government. We already have, even in the last 48 hours, we have a letter from the British Prime Minister to the EU saying that they no longer accept that they have the commitments that they made in December 2017, which were serious commitments in terms of protecting the Good Friday Agreement, guaranteeing there would be no hard border infrastructure on the island of Ireland. If all else fails, they committed to regulatory alignment as a way of preventing border infrastructure.
But all that has now changed, Taoiseach. Let me back in there for a moment.
No, but
and
sorry,
you're the first person
with
to
respect,
point out.
I don't think it's your job to do the selling for Boris Johnson.
No, but it is my job to ask how prepared this government is
and
if
we
there
are
is
prepared,
a no-deal Brexit.
But our preparation in the context of a no deal has to be with the EU, because we are an EU member state. We're going to stay as an EU member state. We're going to stay in the customs union and single market. And we have to work with our EU partners in the context of a contingency plan if we don't have a partner in the British government.
And on it went. Here's a little more.
But we need to perhaps also think about ourselves here, which is, I know what you do as Taoiseach.
That's my job, to protect Irish people in Ireland.
The best boy in the EU class at the risk of ruining all future relationships with the UK, is that a very high risk strategy? And therefore, is there any kind of compromise?
We're not, you shouldn't characterise this as being the best boy and being somehow anti-British, which is what you seem to be suggesting. We are the opposite to that. We are trying to ensure that we manage the relationships on this island in a way that is consistent with our responsibilities under the Good Friday Agreement. And we are trying to ensure that the UK government does the same. We are trying to ensure that we have a trading relationship between Britain and Ireland in the future that protects relationships. Ireland is a confident young country now that expects to negotiate on an equal basis with the UK, despite the differences in scale and size of our economies. And we have been doing that through this process. I have been always respectful of the British position. We have reshaped and changed the backstop and how it was designed.
The backstop, because now we might be in the worst case scenario.
Quite the opposite. If we didn't have the backstop now, we wouldn't have truthful answers to how we can comprehensively solve the border challenge.
Taoiseach Simon Coveney with Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. Now, you might think that the UK and Ireland would be familiar enough with our respective histories and psyches to be able to work this out more amicably. But the chasm of understanding between our two countries is a little deeper and wider than you might think. Writer Daisy Goodwin spoke to Ryan Tuberty during the week and confessed that her knowledge of the Irish famine was, well, less comprehensive than she might like.
I'm afraid, and this is a shocking confession on my part, I mean, I read history at Cambridge, but I really had no idea of the sort of enormity of what happened in the famine. And I should have known better, but I think it wasn't really something, it was only really dealt with from the English point of view. And what I didn't know was the kind of the justifications that the English government put forward for their failure to act. And it was really, I think, on the lines of, I think they actually used the word natural wastage. They were following the philosophy of a guy called Malthus, who basically thought that populations were self-correcting and that famine, although it was unfortunate, was just part of that. And there was what we would now call a great deal of victim blaming, that somehow the Irish had brought this upon themselves by planting too many potatoes and being too dependent on one crop. Actually, people in England have a very, very sketchy idea of what happened during the famine. Really, they don't know. I think there is this tendency, and it's really shocking to somehow blame the Irish for the situation. And I think that is heartbreaking, actually. I feel so angry about it. I mean, I have an 18-year-old daughter. She doesn't know what the IRA is. Yeah. I mean, she's never heard of it.
Really?
And I think there is a whole generation that's growing up that has no memory of the very troubled relationship between, you know, our two countries. And they don't understand it.
Writer Daisy Goodwin with Ryan. And we will be back and Brexit-free, I promise, after this break. Welcome back. Brona Gallagher was the guest on the Collins Collection on Sunday, and she spoke about getting a role in Pulp Fiction, which she heard about after having a really good time at the Blues Festival in Clifton.
And we'd all been on the Mad One on the weekend, dancing and singing and partying and having the crack. We went on the Friday, you know, and we all surfaced on the Monday morning, like the Grateful Dead, coming up the road from Galway. And I rung my mother from Kong to say, "Oh, Mum, everybody wishes, where are you? Where are you?" And I was like, "Kong? You're meant to be on a plane the night." She says, "Your man Tarantino's after ringing and you're meant to be on the plane." They brought it forward a week and I was like, "Ooh." So the bus couldn't get any quicker, you know, got up the road, back to Dublin, went to the house, packed, showered, straight to Dublin Airport. My lovely flatmate, Phil Callery, the gorgeous singer from The Voice Squad, done a two, you know, on two wheels out to Dublin Airport and on the plane. And so I was like Keith Richards getting off it, and I arrived in the hotel, and this lovely girl met me off the plane in a sort of white pickup truck with the flames on the side, which later became the inspiration for Kill Bill, for Uma's truck. So all these characters, like all these people that he just collected, you know, totally out there people. He had a big wad of cash and an envelope for me, like per diem. So I mean, I think it was about $1,000 in this envelope for the 2 weeks, whatever, and a bunch of flowers. And this girl standing there like something out of sort of a pin-up magazine.
Now that is the way to land in Hollywood. But then it was into the studio with cakes, kumquats, and of course, Travolta.
And I'm sitting in this massive studio on my own with all these lovely cakes. And it was the first time I'd seen a kumquat, all these kumquats and donuts and all this thing. On my own, because I was early, everybody else was late. And then the door opens and in walks John Travolta. So I was totally starstruck. Because I mean, I, as a kid, that was the movie, wasn't it? Grease and Saturday Night Fever. But he was a dote. And he was so sweet and took me all around the studio and showed me where they shot the, it was at MGM Paramount then they bought it, where they shot The Wizard of Oz and the wee room where Judy Garland had her dressing room. You know, it was kind of a magical experience and low budget, small film. Nobody knew that it was going to end up becoming the film that it did, you know. But you could see him, when you seen him in action on set, because Travolta was quite, you know, the energy was quite wild and he would be sort of talking when he shouldn't have been talking, you know, like a kid sort of excited, like we all were excited. But when you seen Quentin sort of stick the nails in and go, right, this is where we're pitching this, and then just totally control the scene, I was like, oh, this boy's good. You know, you just kind of knew there was something seriously gifted about him. And but nobody could predict the film and the effect it was going to have. I mean, I was in Scotland a year later when it was coming out on a job and my mum rang me and she said that the films, that film you did in America is after one on the Palme d'Or. And I was like, what? the Pulp Fiction, the wee film. So that's the vibe. And then all of a sudden, boom, so mental.
Boom is right. That was Brona Gallagher on the Collins Collection on Sunday. Now, it's not over yet, but August did turn a little soggy bottom on us during the week.
There surely can't be any more rain left up there, can there?
Ah, poor rain-sodden Gavin Jennings. Although, it being Ireland, chances are we're back in the shorts. And for many, they're still in holiday mode. And with holidays comes a time to reflect, take stock, step off the treadmill and reimagine our busy lives. Ryan Tuberty was on the road in Skull in County Cork on Monday, and he heard from a man who had taken a look at his work-life balance and made some changes. This is Eddie Brennan, who had been working as a manager at an NCT centre in Skibbereen.
I just got to a stage where I couldn't do the job anymore. I didn't want it. I couldn't do it. I didn't like it. And a friend of mine rang me up one time that I hadn't spoken in a long time, and he kind of put the whole thing into perspective for me. He said that giving bad news to people every day was no way to go through life. And I kind of decided there and then to try and find something else to do.
Because the bad news you would be passing on was to say your car's
a crock. It's not an easy job to do, like, in any sense, but it's a job that you're either maybe cut out for you or not. And yeah. I found after a few years I wasn't able to do it.
Okay. There's a lot of people listening this morning who are either in work or on their way in would feel exactly that way about the job, that it's not giving them the satisfaction that maybe the people they're working with aren't, you know, the most pleasant in the world. And what do you do with that?
Of course, only an idiot would argue the fact that health is the single most important thing in life, but the second most important thing is time and how you spend it. And, you know, people just need to maybe sit down and take stock of how they're spending time and try and find somewhere else to spend it.
Of course, of course. Yeah. So what did you do? You sat down and said, right, I'm out, but how do you get out? How do you plan?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Miriam, who my beautiful, beautiful wife, and we sat down, and we have three children, and we were always trying to think of maybe if we could do something, a local business, buy a local business that we could have as a family business and do something together. And this shop came up for sale, Barnett's the Skull. The shop was there since 1948, this old drapery shop, traditional drapery shop. And I was there, I'm born and bred here, and I used to go in there with my mother when I was 5 or 6 years of age, putting on Gola shoes, you know, which we still stock to this day. And we bought our little clothes shop.
Eddie Brennan with Ryan on Monday on changing jobs and a whole way of life. Alternative ways of working were also discussed with Ray Darcy, and one company had introduced a 4-day working week. This is Margaret Cox, company director of the ICE Group in Galway. Now, Ray was just back from his holidays and he seemed very anxious to hear more about this one.
Well, the way we look at it is every week is a bank holiday weekend. It's as simple as that. You know, so either you're off on a Monday or you're off on a Friday, but you have 3 days off every week. And amazing
what,
the difference.
What about, because, you know, people, a number of people said to me today, because I'm back from 3 weeks holidays, have you got the fear, you know, you know, because it's back after 3 weeks. And there is that thing, everybody, whether they admit it or not, when it comes to Monday, they have a bit of the jitters.
Yeah,
but if you have 3 days off, there might be double the jitters, or at least 1.5 times the jitters.
I think what you have is you have the energy and you have the enthusiasm to come back into the job again. And you know that 4 days and you're off again, it's that certainty that I'll have 3 days off every single week. And I'll go into work, I'll work as hard as I possibly can. I make sure to get my... Because we all know, the weeks with the bank holiday in it, we always get our job done.
Yes.
I mean, it's not that you don't get your job done.
Yeah.
You do get your job done. There's no reason why we can't do it every single week.
A 4-day working week, wouldn't that be tempting? Well, Ray also chatted to Ireland AM's Mark Cagney about finishing work after 20 years, and his timetable would make your eyes water.
Now, sitting in front of me is a man who's been up every weekday, well, the majority of weekdays for the last 20 years, at 4 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock.
3:15, down in front of the TV, watching either Sky or BBC with my porridge.
I read 4. Why are we up at 3:15?
Because I'm a basket case.
Right.
Yeah, just, I'm a creature of habit. I do not like, I'm not one of these people who can get up out of bed, you know, into the shower, out into the car with a cup of coffee, mug of coffee and wet hair and all the rest. That's uncivilised. Just can't do that. I need to get up. I need to wake up properly. I want to do it in a sort of a leisurely, dignified way. You know, gentleman way.
God, there's nothing gentle or dignified about those hours. Well, that's the getting up. But what about the going to bed? And also his future plans. And how is he coping with the death of his wife, Anne?
I haven't been out midweek in
20 years. And that's what I didn't ask you. What time are you going to bed at?
9.
Nine.
Light goes out at 9.
Right, yeah. You have your life back.
for the time being. But we'll see. Who knows where it goes next, Ray? I mean, look, on one level, it's scaring the bejesus out of me because I've no idea. But on another level, I've been incredibly lucky.
Mm.
Very lucky, because there's never been a plan and something has always happened. And not just lucky in career, but lucky in life and love too. I mean,
oh well, you've been unlucky now, if that's the well, tragedy,
I know,
in your life.
You if you're talking about Anne, it was awful. Of course it's awful to lose your the love of your life like that. But better to look at it this way. Wasn't I amazingly lucky to have her?
Yeah.
And I had for 16 years what a lot of people never get at all. So, and what saved my sanity, and God, if there's anybody out there going through this, going through a bereavement, the way to save your sanity and not go into that pit of despair is be absolutely delighted and lucky for what you had, not bitter and twisted about what you've lost. That's the gift.
Yeah.
Now, easier said than done, and I didn't get there easily, but anything else, that way madness lies.
Mark Cagney with Ray. The Amazon is burning at an increase of 85% this year so far. And Brazilian President Bolsonaro is blaming these fires on environmentalists, something the Taoiseach described as Orwellian. Erica Berenger is a senior research associate at Oxford University, and she's lived and worked in the Brazilian rainforest for 10 years. Her words are stark.
The Amazon doesn't burn naturally. Fires do not occur naturally in the Amazon rainforest, as it occurs in other systems, like, for example, in Californian forests or in Australian savannas. In the Amazon, they do not occur. So for fires to start in Amazon, they need a human ignition. So basically need someone to start a fire. If we take all the carbon that is stored in all the trees that we have in Amazon rainforest, and we cut all those trees down and burn them, would be the equivalent of 100 years of fossil fuel emissions coming from the USA. That's how much carbon the Amazon stores. So it's a vital component to help us fight climate change is to keep the Amazon standing. There is nothing that we can do that would correspond to the amount of carbon of CO2 that the Amazon takes out of the atmosphere. There's nothing that we can do to substitute the Amazon. And not only that, it's not only about climate change, but also about biodiversity. The Amazon is the most biodiverse forest in the world.
Erica Berenger on Friday's Morning Ireland. Well, poor old Ed Sheeran was getting it in the neck when his school report made it to the papers.
Ed Sheeran got all Fs at music school. The singer-songwriter failed in every subject, including musicianship and songcraft. I mean, everything. I mean, I wouldn't mind if he got a C, the odd B, and maybe one F for non-attendance. But to get an F in seven different grades, how that school is still going? I mean, he's currently worth 175 million euro.
However, money meant sweet, well, if you'll allow me this, FA, to Dave Fanning at the weekend. Simon Marr had come in to talk about standout debut albums. And needless to say, Dave was being his usual measured self.
Okay, The Clash, right?
The Clash, yeah.
The Clash, what a great
debut album. In fact, yeah. I don't care what you want to say, listen to this.
Go from that to Ed bleeding Sheeran.
I don't know. Yeah, but there is nothing
What's
more
wrong with the youth of today.
There is nothing more.
God, those young people, eh? I don't know. Now, Liveline has had a grand old summer. The usual dogs off leashes, Scientologists overcharging, and general state of the nation affairs. But on Wednesday, a seemingly innocuous topic made Daddy angry. Very angry indeed. Blanath phoned in to talk about getting treated for cancer, and she objected to people smoking in the grounds of the hospital. Fair enough, you might think, and hardly guaranteed to get the Liveline switchboard lighting up. Until Dahi came on.
This smoking thing makes me feel like this country has gone way too far. We're listening to American, Irish people that are American.
But the evidence against smoking at this stage is irrefutable.
Is it now? What report can you quote about being affected? No, but hold on. There are no reports about children being affected in homes from smoking, passive smoking. They're just, if the evidence was there, Joe, we'd be listening to it every day of the week, and it's not there.
It is there. It is there.
I don't hear any of it being quoted anytime, anywhere.
Do you think smoking is good for you?
Well, I personally enjoy smoking. I love smoking.
Certainly a point of view, albeit not one really heard since the great smoking ban wars of 2004, but there we go. And Blanet was well able.
Isn't there a road out in the street there with cars passing by and the air quality there is absolutely awful, blown into the hospital?
Well, I wasn't sitting on a bench beside a car with the engine running, guys.
Well, where are the smokers supposed to go? By your rules, we can't go to a hospital. That's grand. That's the time for the end of all. You have a very posh life. I bet you've flown in planes loads of times. As a result, footprint is way larger. So don't be high moral ground. You're getting rid of the smokers. You're shoving them into a corner.
I don't think they should be in a corner. I think they should be in a building far away from the main building in the hospital.
We're very intolerant these days, aren't we?
It's got nothing to do with intolerance. It's got to do with health. Excuse me, Zahi, you haven't walked in my shoes. You have not gone through the chemotherapy I've been through. You have not got a child at home like I have as a single parent, having lost her partner in death. And that child only has one parent. So I'm going through a situation where I'm keeping myself alive for my family, and I don't need to get sick again on the grounds of the hospital.
And I'm absolutely within my rights. Won't affect your health one bit whatsoever.
Well, if somebody sits down beside me on a bench when I'm looking for fresh air, I do not need to be inhaling your cigarette.
And it was then that Papa Joe got cross. Very cross.
You need to check yourself now, Dahi, on a couple of levels. First of all, the evidence on smoking is irrefutable worldwide. Instead of shouting at a woman who told you the situation she's in. Right? The evidence against smoking is irrefutable. You talk about where's the space for you to smoke. There's more space in this country for you to smoke than there is than you to not smoke.
There's more space.
There is more space in this country for you to smoke than not to smoke.
It's a healthcare facility.
You have the Phoenix Park. You have Herbert Park. You have Anne's Park. You have Markovitch Park. You have Fitzgerald Park. You have every street in the country. So stop this guff out of you about you've nowhere to smoke. It is guff. If you don't mind me saying so. It is guff. And don't talk, and do not talk to a woman who's just told you her situation. Do not talk to her like that. Do not talk to her like that. We'll be back after this break.
Okay, bye.
Apologise.
I'm off to find a cold compress and a darkened room. And we're back. Dublin old school actor and writer Emmett Kerwin was the guest on Second Captains this week. And class differences, free market economics, the housing crisis and rampant tourism were all in his sights. And he recalled his college days and the inequality penny dropping.
I took a job on the weekends and I remember being very aware of that I couldn't go out to kind of like, we were getting free tickets to go to see shows and matinees and I was always the one that had to work. So I had to work on Saturday and Sunday. So I remember kind of coming to that kind of realisation in third year. I was like, there's people here that get
there's
like,
a reason why I have to do this.
Yeah. Right. And there's a reason why I'm physically wrecked. And there's a reason why, like, you know, and then you go, you know, and something that people are coming, that kind of the ridiculous kind of thing of the Republic of Opportunity or Equality of Opportunity. You get 600 points and you're leaving, but then you get up to Dublin and your rent is like 10 grand. And then, well, actually, it's not a Republic of Opportunity because if you don't have the money to live and work within this city, then you can't go to the college that you should be going to.
Well, it's interesting you bring the city up because I've heard you say that you do, like, I know Dublin does get bashed a little bit, but you do actually love the city.
Yeah.
As it is, but there are obviously, you know, there are plenty of issues and you've highlighted one there. How do you compare Dublin now to even the city you would have come up in, say, 10 years ago?
Well, it's, you know, and this is something that we've all kind of talked about and we can see it happening all around us. It starts with art and it ends in real estate. You know, everybody was kind of at the crash kind of thing. It was like, what can we do? There's all these kind of spaces that we can make alive. You know what I mean? So there's places like District 8, like the Tivoli, or, you know, art spaces that all of a sudden the place down in Smithfield artists come in, they revitalise these kind of areas, they make these areas places, destinations for tourists that would want to go, and they give it the city its lifeblood and its culture. And then all of a sudden someone figures out that they can make money out of, and they get rid of all the artists and they put a hotel there, but then there's no culture left. So essentially the lifeblood of the city is being sucked out of it. And well, one of the major things as well, like Airbnb, you know, you have a situation where, this bizarre situation where there's private, you know, private residential properties that within planning law are supposed to be used for private residential usage, but are have stag parties in them, and then hotels have homeless families in them. You know what I mean? And this is kind of an idea to people, the people that rule us, to go, well, that's just the way things are. And if there's money to be made, what are you going to do about it?
Emmett Kerwin on fire on second captains. But what about his sporting achievement?
8 years old and Tala learning the Fosbury flip, is it?
The Fosbury flip. That's for the uninitiated, that's the high jump essentially that you see in the Olympics where people spin themselves around and jump back.
They flip their legs over. It's like a scorpion kind of thing. Exactly. Because prior to that, people used to run and just jump back.
We actually won quite a few gold medals at the old style, I think, didn't we, in the 1920s or something? Just generally renowned for leaping.
You just run and it's like jumping over a small fence or a garden wall.
Yeah, we were brilliant. After that, though, not so much.
Then it all went downhill. Yeah. There was always the thing about Santry. You know, we need to qualify for Santry as if Santry was some sort of brilliant kind of like shining city on a hill. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what that meant. But you went to Belfield, then you went to Santry, and it was like, that was what you were trying to qualify for. That was all our teachers kept on saying, like, you need to improve your times and your heights if you're going to get to Santry. You know? And I was just like, oh, Santry, one day, Ma, that's going to be me, you know? And then I got to Santry, and it was like deeply, not that it was disappointing, but it was like, I don't know, it just wasn't El Dorado.
Sure.
Fosbury flopster Emmett Kerwin on second captains. On the Rolling Wave, fiddle player Martin Hayes talked about the beauty of simplicity and the courage of paring back music to its bare bones. And Aoife McCormack recalled how this approach had showed her how much more a tune could yield.
The first time I heard you play The Britches, it was a January or a February night. I was coming home on the top floor of a double-decker bus one awful evening, and I heard you play this tune, and I thought, because that was the first tune I'd ever learnt as a kid, and I thought it was a baby tune, you know, that there was nothing in it. And then suddenly I heard it and I thought, God, no, actually, there's way more here than I ever knew existed. Yeah. And it's a lesson in that it doesn't matter how simple the thing is, there's always something there.
Simplicity is the ultimate challenge, because not because it's difficult to play or not anything like that. It's just difficult to be okay with it. It's just difficult to say, okay, my playing is not about what I can do, but it's about the beauty of the thing itself. So, you know, to sit up on a stage and play something that you look out and you say, well, 50% of the audience should be able to do this. Then you have to actually ask yourself, well, what am I doing up here then? If anybody could do that, you know, what's the justification for me sitting on the stage doing something that simple? But of course, it's about the beauty of the piece, and it's about the beauty of the experience, and it's about the energy and feeling that arises in the space from doing that and nothing else.
Martin Hayes with a little bit of The Britches is heard on The Rolling Wave. Now, what's a good way to get killed off? Well, if you're an actor in Vikings, there's a hierarchy of the bloody demise. Nothing short of a flaying, followed by a dismemberment, and then, if you're really on the up, a nasty beheading. But not so for actor Mo Dunford. He spoke to Ryan Tuberty from Ardmore in Waterford.
Morgan O'Sullivan, who's yeah. producer, and Keith Thompson, they have a way of approaching cast members and telling them how they're going to get killed off. And normally it's by beheading or a poison arrow.
It's Vikings, remember,
it's
of course.
Vikings. Yes, yeah. And to me, they said, well, Mo, we're very happy with your time here. You've, you know, given fantastic whatever, and you actually die of a bee sting. And I misheard him. I thought he said basting.
Like getting the head punched off you or something.
Or, getting, you know, dipped in whatever.
Oil or
hot oil.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, it was a bee sting. He died. He went into anaphylactic shock.
Do you have any comeback on that? Could you not think of a bigger animal?
I thought I misheard them because I thought it was a joke. But Michael Hurst, the writer, he wanted to kill him in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
There weren't any Vikings around in England at the time in those episodes. My contract had expired. So I had to make it work.
How do you make that work?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I saw an episode of Bear Grylls once where he got stung by a bee. So.
There's your research.
Yeah.
Done and dusted.
Yeah.
Done and dusted, all right. That was Mo Dunford with Ryan. Students with disabilities face having their rehabilitative training allowance axed next month. The weekly allowance of €31.80 aims to support progression to further education or employment. Miriam O'Callaghan spoke to Conor Dillon, a student at the Central Remedial Clinic and a member of its Human Rights Committee.
It's unfair to cut this payment because I would use it for trips and I would use it for buying my lunch out and also, we attend classes in the community. I feel annoyed. I feel like I'm being discriminated against because most of my friends that are already on the RT course that I'm starting in September have already got this allowance, and it's only the new members that it will be affecting. So. I would say I would want them to give it back to me and reinstate it.
Conor Dillon speaking about the cut of €31.80 to his weekly allowance with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday. On Arena, filmmaker Mark Cousins spoke to Kay Sheehy about the troubles on film. And she asked him about the 1947 Carol Reed film, Odd Man Out.
You situate yourself in the Crown Bar in Belfast, and that's where James Mason was filmed as the IRA man in The Odd Man Out. Tell us why that is an important film.
It was just so beautiful. It was so textured. My mum and dad drank in the Crown Bar, you know, so I knew it in real life. And then there it was on screen, like in a film noir. The Odd Man Out looks like it's got the colours of a pint of Guinness, you know, it's velvety black and almost creamy white, you know, and there's something magical, something velvet-like, dreamlike about that film. He's never explicitly identified as an IRA man, but as you say, you know, he probably is. And so, you know, when you're living in the sort of grim everyday of a war, to see it poeticized, to see it turned into something flickering almost, was very special.
He also spoke about how art and cinema had helped show him the world.
I think that the powers that be on both sides liked to control us. You know, it felt as if they wanted to keep us scared, keep us imprisoned. But you can't imprison people's imaginations, you know, and our imaginations, especially when you're young, you are hungry for the world. I hadn't been in love. I hadn't been to France. I hadn't been to New York. But I saw love in films, and I saw France in films, and I saw New York in films. And it just set me up for the rest of my life. It sort of felt to me as if cinema took me by the hand and said, let me show you the world.
Mark Cousins on Arena. Sunken Armada gold and a group of divers who claimed to have found a wreck 50 years ago. But did they? Have you been following Treasure Island, the hunt for the Falcon Blanco? Well, if so, you will have been glued to the wireless for the final instalment. Philip Boucher-Hayes dove down to the seabed with a glint in his eye.
On the way down, I thought about how the underwater archaeological team had spent weeks swimming over a canyon in Sligo until a superstorm in the Atlantic shifted tons of sand, revealing what had been buried since September 1588. I kneeled on the bottom and stuck my hand into the sand to see how deep it would go. Without really applying any force, it slid up to my wrist like a hot knife into butter. I was observing that I could have stuck my hand in just inches away from an anchor on either side and I wouldn't have known it. This was going to be the work of a lifetime, not just a month of Sundays. Never mind a four-day dive trip.
Ooh, adventure on the high seas. And if you haven't caught Treasure Island, you've got a treat in store. So drop anchor, me hearties, and podcast. Arr. Sorry, Philip. No excuse. Ardlo Hanlon spoke to Ryan yesterday, and he talked about performing for a mixed Brexit audience, being the son of a politician, and the general coarsening of political debate. And his morning routine mirrored that of many of us, I suspect.
It's a very strange world we live in. I mean, I think the big problem is, you know, we all take it too seriously and too personally ourselves in some senses. You know, like, I don't know about you, but I wake up in the morning, first thing I do would be, you know, grab my phone or stick on Morning Ireland. And, you know, so for the first hour of your day, you're listening to the latest Trump outburst or the latest Brexit nonsense or the crazy man in Brazil and the fires.
Yeah.
This is before you've spoken a civil word to anyone else, before you've hugged anyone, before you've listened to Kate Bush, before you've had your toast, before you've stroked the dog, you know.
Yeah.
And you're starting every day appalled and outraged. Yeah, and it's not healthy,
no,
Ryan.
It's not healthy.
And you're talking about it now. We could be talking about anything
but
pleasant. And
Ardlo Hanlon with Ryan. Well, one man taking it very personally is Donald Trump. He wants to buy Greenland. And curiously enough, the Danes declined. In fact, they said it was absurd. The Donald's feelings were hurted. Very hurted.
I thought that the Prime Minister's statement that it was absurd, it was an absurd idea, was nasty. I thought it was an inappropriate statement. All she had to do is say, no, we wouldn't be interested. But I thought it was a very not nice way of saying something. They could have told me no.
Diddums. They could have just said no. They kind of did. But President Trump was so hurted in his heart that he cancelled his state visit to Denmark. And this is only the latest in slightly odd behaviour. Here's RTE's Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan on Morning Ireland.
Critics say Donald Trump has overreacted on this one and he's really gone too far. And they're also saying that it's an example of a series of strange behaviour that we've seen in recent days from the US president. He recently accused Jewish people who vote Democrat of being disloyal. Yesterday on Twitter, he quoted a conservative talk show host who said that Jewish people in Israel love Donald Trump like he's the king of Israel and the second coming of God. And later on that day, while he was speaking to reporters at the White House about the current trade war with China, Donald Trump looked up to the sky with his hands raised and said, "I am the chosen one."
Of course he is, both the king and the chosen one. Still not getting Greenland though. I got this feeling on the summer day when you were gone. I crashed my car into the bridge, I watched, I let it burn. I threw your stuff into a bag and pushed it down the stairs. I crashed my car into the bridge. I don't care. I love it. I don't care. I got this feeling on the summer day when you were gone. I crashed my car into the bridge, I watched, I let it burn. I threw your stuff into a bag and pushed it down the stairs. I crashed my car into the bridge. I don't care. I love it. I don't care. You're on a different road, I'm in the Milky Way. You want me down on Earth, but I am up in space. You're so damn hard to please, we gotta kill this switch. You're from the 70s, but I'm a 90s chick. Bit of dancing for a finish. That is it from Playback for this week. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.